Minor prophet Hosea. We are in chapter 9 in our study through this book. And over the past few years, as you know, we have looked at a different minor prophet each year, worked our way through those lessons, observing them in the historical context, but also to understand and appreciate their value and the lessons as they apply to us today. It seems to me the most basic and fundamental lessons about life and our relationship with God are affirmed in these minor prophet books. Lessons about God's love and His provision. Lessons about our duty and responsibility to know God and to know His will and to obey it. And lessons about the consequences when we fail to do that. These are themes that are on practically every page of the Bible. And they are especially evident in these prophets who prophesied to these nations of people who were on the cusp of reaping God's punishment because they just weren't listening. They weren't paying attention. And they had let the details slip, and that leaven had leavened the whole nation. Chapter 9 is another layer of what is coming upon the nation of Israel because of their conduct and behavior. And this nation is a perpetual reminder of the fact that God will not tolerate rejection. He's made us free moral agents. He's given individuals and nations the ability to choose to reject Him. But He'll not tolerate the rejection, and there will be consequences for that. You can very easily, I think, divide chapter 9 of Hosea into two parts. You have verses 1 through 9, and then you have verses 9 through 17. This is a relatively short chapter, and I think it would serve us well to just go through verse by verse in these sections and make the observations that are there for us to see and observe. Verses 1 through 9, this first section, you could look at it under the title or the heading or the theme, "Do Not Rejoice, O Israel." When I read that, I think of Ecclesiastes chapter 3, where Solomon talked about the time, a time to mourn, a time to laugh, a time to rend, a time to sew back together. There's a time that is appropriate. And you know, and I know, in life there are times that are appropriate and then there are times that aren't appropriate. In a time of distress and difficulty, it's not really an appropriate time to laugh and joke. Or a time of mourning is not typically a good time for celebration and laughter. Well, here you have the nation of Israel evidently rejoicing when rejoicing is not appropriate. That's not where their minds and their hearts ought to be. And the prophet says, don't rejoice. And let's notice what the evidence is or why he says these things to them. Look at verse 1 of chapter 9. "Do not rejoice, O Israel, with joy like other peoples. For you have played the harlot against your God. You have made love for hire on every threshing floor." He says, you are just like the others. And immediately we would think about the nations among whom they dwell, the nations that they were to drive out because of those nations' rejection of God. You're coming in, you're driving these out, people out, you're displacing them, you're destroying them because of the way they've treated God and the way they have responded to God. So don't rejoice like those nations. They are guilty of spiritual adultery. They're guilty of idolatry. They're guilty of immorality. And here you are, under their influence, guilty of the same things. Israel was guilty of spiritual adultery. They had begun to worship other gods and had not worshiped the God of heaven exclusively. They had engaged in the pagan worship rites. And so they are adulterous spiritually, and their immorality is evident through their participation in the pagan worship practices, the worship of Baal and other false religions that were engaged in by the people around them. Look at verse 2. He says, "The threshing floor and the winepress shall not feed them, and the new wine shall fail in her." The threshing floor, the winepress, symbols of their labor for produce to sustain and provide for themselves. But these places had also now become the site of the sins in which they were engaged. Not only did they work in those areas to provide food and sustenance, but they engaged in idolatrous worship practices there and associated the blessings of those places with the blessings of these false gods that they had come to worship. Look at verse 3. "They shall not dwell in the Lord's land, but Ephraim," and remember we've talked about Ephraim being synonymous with Egypt. Ephraim, one of the larger tribes, and so these terms are used interchangeably. "But Ephraim shall return to Egypt." I would not suggest literal Egypt here, but Egypt is a symbol of slavery. And they're going into slavery. They would recall the situation of their ancestors in Egypt. And they would be able to envision the fact that now they're headed to the same situation. But more literally, look at the latter part of the verse. "You shall eat unclean things in Assyria." Assyria is where they're going. Slavery, Egypt. But their captivity is in Assyria, and that captivity awaited them, and in that place, they would eat undefiled food. Do you think the armies of Assyria and those their captors would care anything about their food practices and their religious rites and behaviors? That stuff wouldn't matter in Assyria. And they would be robbed of that distinction there, and they would eat food that would have considered unclean, because they're not now their own people. They've rejected God and they've become, or will become, captives of another. Look at verse 4. "They shall not offer wine offerings to the Lord, nor shall their sacrifices be pleasing to him. It shall be like bread of mourners to them. All who eat it shall be defiled, for their bread shall be for their own life. It shall not come into the house of the Lord." You know, it's one thing when the produce that you provide, you're able to use it in worship to your God. You're able to use those things in the worship practices that God has prescribed. But it's another point altogether when the only food you have is enough to survive. And it would no longer be a day where they would have bountiful provisions and they would look at it and say, "This is what God has blessed. Let me take the best of it and offer it to God." You won't do that in Assyria. You'll take what you get, and it will be food for survival. A much different situation. The bread that they have would be like the bread for mourning for the dead, a ceremony or a funeral where the dead are honored, because they are indeed dead as a nation, having been taken into captivity. And this is all in foresight, as Hosea tells them, this is what's coming their way. Look at verse 5. "What will you do in the appointed day, and in the day of the feast of the Lord?" What are you going to do? You know, think about it this way for us. If we have been in a situation where we've been taken captive as Christians, and we've been confined and our activities have been restricted because we have rejected our God and we've not obeyed Him, and now The fruit of our rejection has blossomed. Now we're in captivity. We can't do what we want to do. And so God asks us through the prophet, what will you do on the Lord's day? What will you do on Sunday when it rolls around? And your activities are restricted and you're confined and you can't with liberty worship your God. Same idea here. On those appointed days, you'll be in captivity. You'll be in chains. You'll not be able to exercise the liberty to offer to God sacrifices and to participate in the worship rites and practices that he has prescribed for you. All communion with God would cease. Look, if we stop worshiping, if we stop assembling together as Christians and worshiping the God of heaven as he has told us to, if whether we do it voluntarily or whether that has been taken from us, we'll soon forget God. Our relationship with him will be cut off because we'll be so distant and separated and out of communion with him. And that's their fate here. All communion with God would cease. And they'll forget him. And they'll be forgotten in captivity. And we know that from this side of the situation, looking back at them. Where is the nation of Israel? When did they ever come back out of captivity and reestablish themselves in the promised land? And when, at least when we get to Judah and the Babylonian captivity of the southern tribes, we see them coming back. But when did Assyria ever, or when did Israel ever make a movement to come back from Assyrian captivity? They just kind of dissolved into history. Look at verse 6. For indeed they are gone because of destruction. Egypt shall gather them up. Memphis shall bury them. Nettles shall possess their valuables of silver. Thorns shall be in their tents. There are a couple of things, actually three things to notice here. Here we're in mind, we're back in Egypt, right? He speaks of Egypt. He speaks of Memphis, which would have been the capital of Egypt. But it's symbolic still because they didn't go there. They went to Assyria. But there's strong symbolism here that they would understand. Egypt is slavery. It's captivity. But the idea of Memphis is an interesting one because, as I understand it, just outside of Memphis in Egypt, there is an enormous cemetery. And in fact, that area is known for the size of that cemetery. And so God, through the prophet, gives this picture of Memphis in Egypt and the site of a vast cemetery that no doubt is full of dead bodies and bones of those who have been destroyed. And that's what you have to look forward to. As a nation who's been taken into captivity, you reject God, and nothing good comes from that. There's other imagery here. There's the imagery of the thistles and the thorns that devour, consume their tents. You know, if you've owned any property at all and you've let it go for a while, you know about thistles and thorns, and how quickly they will overtake land that is not worked and that is not occupied and that is not groomed and taken care of. You're leaving this land, and the thistles and thorns will overtake your tents, your silver, your possessions. It will be a wasteland. I mentioned in class this morning that the king of Assyria tried to counter that by taking people from other nations and bringing them in and populating that land. But God even plagued those people with wild beasts and lions that attacked them. But look at what Hosea is saying to them about this place where they felt secure. This place where they felt the need and the right to rejoice. Don't rejoice. It's not a time for rejoicing. It's a time for mourning. because you're going to be destroyed and you're going into captivity. Verse 7. The days of punishment have come. The days of recompense have come. Israel knows. The prophet is a fool. The spiritual man is insane because of the greatness of your iniquity and great enmity. The day has come. I think it's interesting that the prophet says Israel knows. Kind of like sometimes with parents, your child will do something, and it, you know, it's just, what were you thinking, right? And you, when the consequences come to bear in that situation, you say, but you, and you probably said this, you should have seen that coming. Seems to me the prophet's saying something similar to that here. You should have seen this coming. You can't reject God and get away with it. He will not tolerate rejection. He'll not override your will and keep you from doing it. But if you make that choice, then you've made the choice to reap the consequences of that choice and that decision as well. The prophet is a fool. The spiritual man, or the spiritual man is insane. Some commentators suggest that this is the people's attitude toward Hosea, that they're saying he's a fool and he's insane. I rather think this is Hosea's description of the prophets that have led the people to this point. Like Jeremiah chapter 6 and verse 17, Jeremiah chapter 6 verse 14. The prophets prophesy falsely, the priests bear rule by their means, and my people love to have it so, Jeremiah said. Well, same thing here. The people have loved the comfort and the assurance that the false messengers have given them. But just because a preacher said it, just because a prophet said it, doesn't make it so. And just because the preacher or the prophet encourages you to rejoice in your present situation, if it's not a good situation, you better not rejoice. Don't rejoice, Israel. It's not time for rejoicing. And then verse 8. The watchman of Ephraim is with my God, but the prophet is a fowler's snare in all his ways, enmity in the house of his God. That first part of verse 8 is not real clear. It's kind of confusing. The watchman of Ephraim is with my God. Well, the watchman, the prophet, the seer, the one who's supposed to be helping the people, if he is with God, then he's exalted himself to that place. And I think that's the idea there. The prophet, instead of telling the people what they needed to hear, he's exalted himself to the place of God as if he can tell it like it's going to be. But he's in the wrong place, and it's no wonder then that the people are in the wrong place as well. The prophet is actually the fowler's snare. He has become a trap for his own people that has resulted in them going into captivity. Instead of being a warner of danger, he's become an agent of danger, and there is no warning. So the prophet says, don't rejoice, Israel. It's not time for that. This is a very desperate time. Now look at verses 9 through 17. In these verses, there are what I think are three evidences of their wholesale corruption. God has warned and warned and warned and warned through the prophets. But now at this time, it's late in the game. And they're on the very verge of going to the place that they most dread, into captivity. Captivity in Assyria. Their corruption is wholesale. They're sold in completely to it. There's no turning back. You're going. Well, what are the three evidences in these verses that demonstrate how they got to this point and this place? I think tremendous practical lessons can be learned in what we'll observe in these next few verses. And there are three places that are associated with these three problems. And we'll notice those as we go. Look at verse 9 for the first one. They are deeply corrupted, as in the days of Gibeah. He will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins. The prophet can say this matter-of-factly because these people would understand the meanings associated with these places that he's using. For you and I, when we hear Gibeah, we have to either think back from our Bible class and Bible study, okay, what happened at Gibeah? Or we have to go searching and look for what the Bible says about that particular place and why it would be highlighted in the accusations that Hosea makes against the people. Well, Gibeah was Saul, King Saul's capital. And you will remember that Saul was the first king of the United Kingdom that resulted from the people rejecting Samuel's sons and saying, "Give us a king like the nations round about us." Now, Samuel was all up in arms about that because he thought they were rejecting him. But you remember in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 7 and 8, the Lord said to him, "Heed what they ask for, give them what they ask for. They've not rejected you, they've rejected me, that I should not reign over them." And that decision, as we've talked about in other lessons in this series, that decision became the launching point for so many problems, especially for the northern kingdom. Every single one of the kings that they appointed was a corrupt king. And many of them came to power by killing the one that was in office. He desired it, so they would just take each other out and assume the place is king. Very corrupt, very wicked individuals. And then in the divided kingdom, of course, that continued with Jeroboam and all who followed him. But Gibeah is the place where that rejection of God's divine government began. God's system of government. They had a king. The God of heaven was their king. But they wanted one like the nations round about them. They looked around and they said, "I kind of like this. Instead of this, I want this." We can do the same thing. God has told us this. But we can look around and say, "I like that. Or I like that." And we can forfeit or we can reject the divine government that God has put in place. We have to be careful because we can be guilty of some of the same things of which they were guilty. Look at verse 10. "I found Israel like green grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first fruits of the fig tree in its first season. But they went to Baal Peor and separated themselves to that shame. They became an abomination like the thing they loved." So here at verse 10, we come to this second reason or this second point of rejection. These people of Hosea's day were surely not cut from the same cloth as their ancestors. God through the prophet says that I saw Israel, I found Israel. He's looking back to their ancestry, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I saw them, I found them in the wilderness. They were like the first fruits of the fig tree. Precious. But then Israel went to Baal Peor. Well, again, we're thinking in our minds, okay, what happened at Baal Peor? What's the significance of that place? Well, Baal Peor is in Moab. And you remember when Balaam wasn't successful in getting a curse upon God's people, then another plot was brought to bear, in which the men of Israel would be seduced into participating in the pagan worship practices of Moab. In Numbers chapter 25, let me just read the first four verses here. Numbers 25, verses 1 through 4. Now Israel remained in Acacia Grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. Then the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. Well, what was Baal Peor? Well, here they rejected God's morality. They rejected his divine government. Now we're dealing with the morality that God has put in place. They rejected it, and they've committed lewd acts in the name of religion to these false gods. Look at verse 11. As for Ephraim, their glory shall fly away like a bird. No birth, no pregnancy, and no conception. A once prolific nation. I mean, you think, as numerous as the stars of heaven, as countless as the sand of the seashore. And now, no birth, no pregnancy, no conception. God has cut off the prolific nature of this nation. No more will they prosper and multiply the way that they have. Look at verse 12. Though they bring up their children, yet I will bereave them to the last man. Yes, woe to them when I depart from them. Here, this seems to me, at least, in thinking about the connections with Egypt and the symbolism, you think about in Egypt the plague that had killed the firstborn of all the families of Egypt and the bereavement that had taken place there. Who had ever thought that Israel would experience the same kind of bereavement that was seen in Israel? And yet the prophet says that's exactly what's going to happen. Even if they do give birth, they will be bereaved in those situations. Look at verses 13 and 14. Just as I saw Ephraim like Tyre, planted in a pleasant place, so Ephraim will bring out his children to the murderer. Give them, O Lord, what will you give? Give them a miscarrying womb and dry breasts. These just further symbols of how the end of their prosperity and posterity will be realized. God is cutting them off as a nation. Look at verse 15. All their wickedness is in Gilgal. Here we have another place. For there I hated them. Because of the evil of their deeds, I will drive them from my house. I will love them no more. And their princes, all their princes are rebellious. Let's notice a few things here. Gilgal. If you look back at the Old Testament, if you use the Bible software or something and just look for Gilgal in the Old Testament, you'll get a number of hits on it, many of which are ones where that place is connected with God blessing this people. In Joshua chapter 4, verses 19 and 20, now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And now listen, those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan River, they set up at Gilgal. That's where the memorial stones were that were taken out of the riverbed that would remind them that God had dried that river up so they could cross over it. That's a place of blessing. That's a place of promise and assurance. How could God say, all their wickedness is in Gilgal? There I hated them. Because of the evil deeds, I will drive them out from my house. I will love them no more. Why the change in attitude from the perspective of God about this place? Well, that place became a place of idol worship and pagan religious practices. Just a couple of passages, Amos chapter 4 and verse 4. Come to Bethel and transgress, at Gilgal multiply transgressions, Amos would say. Bring your sacrifices every morning and your tithes every 3 days. They had made it a place of false worship. We'll get to Hosea chapter 12, but Hosea chapter 12 verse 11 says, through Gilead, though Gilead has idols, surely they are vanity. Though they sacrifice bulls in Gilgal, indeed their altars shall be heaps in the furrows of the field. They had turned a place of blessing into a place of cursing. And so that's why God has animosity toward that place, because that's the place where they rejected his sovereignty. They've rejected his government, they've rejected his morality, and they've rejected his sovereign rule and reign over them as the only God that is to be worshipped. And then look at verse 16. Ephraim is stricken, their root is dried up, they shall bear no fruit. Yes, were they to bear children, I would kill the darlings of their womb. Very striking language. Their root is dried up. I can't help but think of Psalm 1. You remember what the psalmist said about the blessed man? He walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, doesn't stand in the way of sinners, doesn't sit in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and it doth he meditate day and night. He shall be like the tree planted by the rivers of water, whose root and leaf never wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. Not so with this nation of people. Their root is dried up. And I would suggest, with respect to the prophet saying, I would kill the darlings of their womb, is imagery of the very people who are going to take them captive. The Assyrian army was a very ruthless army. And that's the kind of people they were dealing with. Just take life and destroy it as they killed and conquered. And then the last verse, verse 17. My God will cast them away because they did not obey him, and they shall be wanderers among the nations. Some 32 nations of people occupied the land that God had given them because he swore to their father Abraham to give it to them. They dispossessed and they destroyed all those nations of people because of their wickedness, because that's what God said to do. And now they've come to the point where they're no better than any of those other nations. God won't tolerate that. They're rejoicing, and their religious leaders are encouraging them to rejoice. But the sensible, sound mind prophet says, don't rejoice, O Israel. You've rejected God. You've rejected his government. You've rejected morality, and you've rejected his sovereignty, and you know it. And you're going to go to the land of captivity. These people were responsible and deserving of their fate. They had a compulsion to rejoice, and we might learn this lesson from them tonight. It is possible to feel like it's okay to rejoice and yet be in a state and situation where we are sinful and corrupt. That's why it's so important for us to know and be reminded about what God says, so we'll know whether we have grounds for rejoicing or whether we need to be tuning up our lives and getting them back in accordance with His will. It's interesting that error and sin have a way of clinging to life and finish what it started. In all of these situations where God responded at their rejection, and yet that leaven continued to leaven the whole lump to the point to where they're a wholesale corrupt nation ready for captivity. May God help us to learn the lessons from history, from this nation of people, how they forgot God, how they rejected Him and didn't take Him seriously. May He help us through this learning about them and reading what the prophet has taught us in His word to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes, even as the church of our Lord today. Tonight, as we bring this service to a close, we want to extend the Lord's invitation to any who may need to obey the gospel through faith, repentance, confession, and baptism for the remission of your sins. You can be remitted. Those sins can be remitted. You can be added to the Lord's church, made a child of God, even tonight. Maybe you have a desire to study further with someone about what God expects of you and what His word teaches you. Maybe as a child of God, you've entered into a relationship with God that's not right, not sound, not wholesome. Maybe you need to restore a right relationship with Him. We're going to sing a song to encourage whatever need there might be. We hope you'll come as we stand and sing.